He raised his left arm. It seemed to float, disembodied before his eyes, a scrawny old man's arm with the muscles deteriorating. He was in a hospital johnny, but it had short sleeves, and he could still read the numbers on the forearm, tattooed there in faded blue ink. P49996521 4. Worse things, yes. Worse things than falling off a suburban stepladder and breaking your back and being taken to a clean and sterile metropolitan hospital and being given a Valium that was guaranteed to bubble your troubles away. There were the showers. They were worse. His first wife, Ruth, had died in one of their filthy showers. There were the trenches that became graves. He could close his eyes and still see the men lined up along the open maw of the trenches, could still hear the volley of rifle fire, could still remember the way they flopped backwards into the earth like badly made puppets. There were the crematoriums. They were worse, too. The crematoriums that filled the air with the steady, sweet smell of Jews burning like torches no one could see. The horror-struck faces of old friends and relatives, faces that melted away like guttering candles, faces that seemed to melt away before your very eyes, thin, thinner, thinnest. Then one day they were gone. Where? Where does a torch flame go when the cold wind has blown it out? Heaven. Hell. Lights in the darkness. Candles in the wind. When Job finally broke down and questioned, God asked him, "Where were you when I made the world?" If Morris Heisel had been Job, he would have responded, "Where were you when my Ruth was dying? You potser, you! Watching the Yankees and the Senators? If you can't pay attention to your business better than this, get out of my face!" Yes, there were worse things than breaking your back, he had no doubt of it. But what sort of God would have allowed him to break his back and become paralyzed for life after watching his wife die and his daughters and his friends? No God at all. That was who. A tear trickled from the corner of his eye and ran slowly down the side of his head to his ear. Outside the hospital room, a bell rang softly. A nurse squeaked by on white crepe-soled shoes. His door was ajar, and on the far wall of the corridor outside he could read the letters N-S-I-V-E-C-A and guess that the whole sign must read Intensive Care. There was movement in the room, a rustle of bedclothes. Moving very carefully, Morris turned his head to the right, away from the door. He saw a night table next to him with a pitcher of water on it. There were two call buttons on the table. Beyond it was another bed, and in the bed was a man who looked even older and sicker than Morris felt. He was not hooked into a giant exercise wheel for gerbils like Morris was, but an IV feed stood beside his bed and some sort of monitoring console stood at its foot. The man's skin was sunken and yellow. Lines around his mouth and eyes had driven deep. His hair was yellowish-white, dry and lifeless. His thin eyelids had a bruised and shiny look, and in his big nose Morris saw the burst capillaries of the lifelong drinker. Morris looked away, and then looked back. As the dawnlight grew stronger and the hospital began to wake up, he began to have the strangest feeling that he knew his roommate. Could that be? The man looked to be somewhere between 75 and 80, and Morris didn't believe he knew anyone quite that old. Except for Lydia's mother, a horror Morris sometimes believed to be older than the Sphinx, whom the woman closely resembled. Maybe the guy was someone he had known in his past. Maybe even before he, Morris, came to America. Maybe. Maybe not. And why all of a sudden did it seem to matter? For that matter, why had all his memories of the camp of Patton come flooding back tonight when he always tried to, and most times succeeded in, keeping those things buried? He broke out in a sudden rash of goose flesh, as if he had stepped into some mental, haunted house where old bodies were unquiet and old ghosts walked. Could that be? Even here and now in this clean hospital, 30 years after those dark times had ended? He looked away from the old man in the other bed, and soon he had begun to feel sleepy again. It's a trick of your mind. That this other man seems familiar. Only your mind amusing you in the best way it can, amusing you the way it used to try to amuse you in. But he would not think of that. He would not allow himself to think of that. Drifting into sleep, he thought of a boast he had made to Ruth, but never to Lydia. It didn't pay to boast to Lydia. She was not like Ruth, who would always smile sweetly at his harmless puffing and crowing. I never forget a face. Here was his chance to find out if that was still so. If he had really known the man in the other bed at some time or other, perhaps he could remember when and where. Very close to sleep, drifting back and forth across its threshold, Morris thought, perhaps I knew him in the camp. That would be ironic indeed. What they called a jest of God. What God? Morris Heisel asked himself again, and slept. 19. Todd graduated salutatorian of his class, just possibly because of his poor grade on the trig final he had been studying for the night Dusander had had his heart attack. It dragged his final grade in the course down to 89, 1 point below an A-minus average. A week after graduation, the Bowdens went to visit Mr. Denker at Santo Donato General. Todd fidgeted through 15 minutes of banalities and thank yous and how do you feels, and was grateful for the break when the man in the other bed asked him if he could come over for a minute. "You'll pardon me," the other man said apologetically. He was in a huge body cast and was for some reason attached to an overhead system of pulleys and wires. "My name is Morris Heisel. I broke my back." "That's too bad," Todd said gravely. "Aye, too bad," he says. "This boy has the gift of understatement." Todd started to apologize, but Heisel raised his hand, smiling a little. His face was pale and tired, the face of any old man in the hospital, facing a life full of sweeping changes just ahead, and surely few of them for the better. In that way, Todd thought, he and Dusander were alike. "No need," Morris said, "no need to answer a rude comment. You are a stranger. Does a stranger need to be inflicted with my problems?" "No man is an island, entire of itself," Todd began, and Morris laughed. "Done," he quotes at me, "a smart kid. Your friend there, is he very bad off?" "Well, the doctors say he's doing fine, considering his age. He's 80. "That old?" Morris exclaimed. "He doesn't talk to me much, you know. But from what he does say, I guess he's naturalized. Like me. I'm Polish, you know. Originally, I mean, from Radom."
"Oh?" Todd said politely.
"Yes. You know what they call an orange manhole cover in Radom?"
"No," Todd said, smiling.
"Howard Johnson's," Morris said, and laughed. Todd laughed, too. Dusander glanced over at them, startled by the sound and frowning a little. Then Monica said something, and he looked back at her again. "Is your friend naturalized?"
"Oh, yes," Todd said.
"He's from Germany. Essen. Do you know that town?"
"No," Morris said.
"But I was only in Germany once. I wonder if he was in the war."
"I really couldn't say." Todd's eyes had gone distant.
"No? Well, it doesn't matter. That was a long time ago, the war. In another 3 years, there will be people in this country constitutionally eligible to become president. President, who weren't even born until after the war was over. To them it must seem there is no difference between the miracle of Dunkirk and Hannibal taking his elephants over the Alps."
"Were you in the war?" Todd asked.
"Well, I suppose I was, in a manner of speaking." "You're a good boy to visit such an old man. Two old men, counting me," Todd smiled modestly.
"I'm tired now," Morris said. "Perhaps I'll sleep."
"I hope you feel better soon," Todd said.
Morris nodded, smiled, and closed his eyes. Todd went back to Dusander's bed, where his parents were just getting ready to leave. His dad kept glancing at his watch and exclaiming with bluff heartiness at how late it was getting. 2 days later, Todd came back to the hospital alone. This time, Morris Heisel, immured in his body cast, was deeply asleep in the other bed.
"You did well," Dusander said quietly. "Did you go back to the house later?"
"Yes. I burned the damned letter. I don't think anyone was too interested in that letter, and I was afraid—"
"I don't know," he shrugged.
Unable to tell Dusander, he'd been almost superstitiously afraid about the letter, afraid that maybe someone would wander into the house who could read German, someone who would notice references in the letter that were 10, perhaps 20 years out of date. "Next time you come, smuggle me in something to drink," Dusander said. "I find I don't miss the cigarettes, but I won't be back again," Todd said flatly. "Not ever. It's the end. We're quits."
Quits. Dusander folded his hands on his chest and smiled. It was not a gentle smile, but it was perhaps as close as Dusander could come to such a thing. "I thought that was in the cards. They're going to let me out of this graveyard next week, or so they promise. The doctor says I may have a few years left in my skin yet. I ask him how many, and he just laughs. I suspect that means no more than 3, and probably no more than 2. Still, I may give him a surprise." Todd said nothing. "But between you and me, boy, I have almost given up my hopes of seeing the century turn."
"I want to ask you about something," Todd said, looking at Dusander steadily. "That's why I came in today. I want to ask you about something you said once."
Todd glanced over his shoulder at the man in the other bed, and then drew his chair closer to Dusander's bed. He could smell Dusander's smell, as dry as the Egyptian room in the museum. "So ask."
"That wino. You said something about me having experience. First-hand experience. What was that supposed to mean?"
Dusander's smile widened a bit. "I read the newspapers, boy. Old men always read the newspapers, but not in the same way younger people do. Buzzards are known to gather at the ends of certain airport runways in South America when the crosswinds are treacherous. Did you know that?" "That is how an old man reads the newspaper. A month ago there was a story in the Sunday paper. Not a front-page story. No one cares enough about bums and alcoholics to put them on the front page. But it was the lead story in the feature section. 'Is someone stalking Santo Donato's down and out?' That's what it was called. Crude. Yellow journalism. You Americans are famous for it."
Todd's hands were clenched into fists, hiding the butchered nails. He never read the Sunday papers. He had better things to do with his time. He had, of course, checked the papers every day for at least a week following each of his little adventures, and none of his stew bums had ever gotten beyond page 3. The idea that someone had been making connections behind his back infuriated him.
"The story mentioned several murders, extremely brutal murders. Stabbings, bludgeonings. Subhuman brutality was how the writer put it, but you know reporters. The writer of this lamentable piece admitted that there is a high death rate among these unfortunates, and that Santo Donato has had more than its share of the indigent over the years. In any given year, not all of these men die naturally or of their own bad habits. There are frequent murders. But in most cases, the murderer is usually one of the deceased degenerate's compatriots. The motive no more than an argument over a penny ante card game or a bottle of Muscatel. The killer is usually happy to confess. He is filled with remorse. But these recent killings have not been solved. Even more ominous to this yellow journalist's mind, or whatever passes for his mind, is the high disappearance rate over the last few years. Of course, he admits again, these men are not much more than modern-day hobos. They come and go. But some of these left without picking up welfare checks or day labor checks from speller work, which only pays on Fridays. Could some of these have been victims of this yellow journalist's wino killer, he asks? Victims who haven't been found? Pah!" Dusander waved his hand in the air, as if to dismiss such errant irresponsibility. "Only titillation, of course. Give people a comfortable little scare on Sunday morning. He calls up old bogies, threadbare but still useful, the Cleveland torso murderer Zodiac, the mysterious Mr. X who killed the Black Dahlia, Spring-Heel Jack, such drivel. But it makes me think. What does an old man have to do but think when old friends don't come to visit anymore?" Todd shrugged. "I thought, If I wish to help this odious yellow dog journalist, which I certainly do not, I could explain some of the disappearances. Not the corpses found stabbed or bludgeoned, not them, God rest their besotted souls, but some of the disappearances, because at least some of the bums who disappeared are in my cellar.
How many down there? Todd asked in a low voice.
Six, Lucinda said calmly. Counting the one you helped me dispose of, six.
You're really nutso, Todd said. The skin below his eyes had gone white and shiny. At some point, you just blew all your fucking wheels.
Blew my wheels? What a charming idiom. Perhaps you're right. But then I said to myself, this newspaper jackal would love to pin the murders and the disappearances on the same somebody, his hypothetical wino killer. But I think maybe that's not what happened at all. Then I say to myself, do I know anybody who might be doing such things? Somebody who has been under as much strain as I have during the last few years? Someone who has also been listening to old ghosts rattle their chains? And the answer is yes. I know you, boy. I've never killed anyone. The image that came was not of the winos. They weren't people, not really people at all. The image that came was of himself crouched behind the dead tree, peering through the telescopic sight of his 30-30, the crosshairs fixed on the temple of the man with the scuzzy beard, the man driving the brat pickup.
Perhaps not, Dusander agreed, amicably enough.
Yet you took hold so well that night. Your surprise was mostly anger at having been put in such a dangerous position by an old man's infirmity, I think. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong, Todd said. I was pissed off at you, and I still am. I covered it up for you because you've got something in a safety deposit box that could destroy my life.
No, I do not.
What? What are you talking about?
It was as much a bluff as your letter left with a friend. You never wrote such a letter. There was never such a friend, and I have never written a single word about our association, shall I call it. Now I lay my cards on the table. You saved my life. Never mind that you acted only to protect yourself. That does not change how speedily and efficiently you acted. I cannot hurt you, boy. I tell you that freely. I have looked death in the face, and it frightens me, but not as badly as I thought it would. There is no document. It is, as you say, we are quits.
Todd smiled, a weird upward corkscrewing of the lips. A strange sardonic light danced and fluttered in his eyes.
Herr Dusander, he said, if only I could believe that.
In the evening, Todd walked down to the slope overlooking the freeway, climbed down to the dead tree, and sat on it. It was just past twilight. The evening was warm. Car headlights cut through the dusk in long yellow daisy chains.
There is no document.
He hadn't realized how completely irretrievable the entire situation was until the discussion that had followed. Dusander suggested Todd search the house for a safety deposit key, and when he didn't find one, that would prove there was no safety deposit box, and hence no document. But a key could be hidden anywhere. It could be put in a Crisco can and buried. It could be put in a Sucrette's tin and slid behind a bore that had been loosened and then replaced. He might even have ridden the bus to San Diego and put it behind one of the rocks in the decorative stone wall which surrounded the bear's environmental area. For that matter, Todd went on, Dusander could even have thrown the key away. Why not? He had only needed it once to put his written documents in. If he died, someone else would take it out. Dusander nodded reluctantly at this, but after a moment's thought he made another suggestion. When he got well enough to go home, he would have the boy call every single bank in Santo Donato. He would tell each bank official he was calling for his grandfather. Poor grandfather, he would say, had grown lamentably senile over the last 2 years, and now he had misplaced the key to his safety deposit box. Even worse, he could no longer remember which bank the box was in. Could they just check their files for an Arthur Denker, no middle initial? And when Todd drew a blank at every bank in town, Todd was already shaking his head again. First, a story like that was almost guaranteed to raise suspicions. It was too pat. They would probably suspect a con game and get in touch with the police. Even if every one of them bought the story, it would do no good. If none of the almost 9 dozen banks in Santo Donato had a box in the Denker name, it didn't mean that Dusander hadn't rented one in San Diego, L.A., or any town in between. At last Dusander gave up. "You have all the answers, boy. All at least but one. What would I stand to gain by lying to you? I invented this story to protect myself from you. That is a motive. Now I am trying to uninvent it. What possible gain do you see in that?" Dusander got laboriously up on one elbow. "For that matter, why would I need a document at all at this point? I could destroy your life from this hospital bed, if that was what I wanted. I could open my mouth to the first passing doctor. They are all Jews. They would all know who I am, or at least who I was. But why would I do this? You are a fine student. You have a fine career ahead of you, unless you get careless with those winos of yours." Todd's face froze. "I told you. I know. You never heard of them. You never touched so much as a hair on their scaly, tick-ridden heads. All right, good, fine. I say no more about it. Only tell me, boy, why should I lie about this? We are quits, you say, but I tell you we can only be quits if we can trust each other." Now, sitting behind the dead tree on the slope which ran down to the freeway, looking at all the anonymous headlights disappearing endlessly like slow tracer bullets, he knew well enough what he was afraid of. Dusander talking about trust. That made him afraid. The idea that Dusander might be tending a small but perfect flame of hatred deep in his heart, that made him afraid, too. A hatred of Todd Bowden, who was young, clean-featured, unwrinkled. Todd Bowden, who was an apt pupil with a whole bright life stretching ahead of him. But what he feared most was Dusander's refusal to use his name. Todd. What was so hard about that, even for an old kraut whose teeth were mostly false? Todd. One syllable. Easy to say. Put your tongue against the roof of your mouth, drop your teeth a little, replace your tongue, and it was out. Yet Dusander had always called him boy. Only that. Contemptuous. Anonymous. Yes, that was it. Anonymous. As anonymous as a concentration camp serial number. Perhaps Dusander was telling the truth. No, not just perhaps. Probably. But there were those fears, the worst of them being Dusander's refusal to use his name. And at the root of it all was his own inability to make a hard and final decision. At the root of it all was a rueful truth. Even after 4 years of visiting Dusander, he still didn't know what went on in the old man's head. Perhaps he wasn't such an apt pupil after all. Cars and cars and cars. His fingers itched to hold his rifle. How many could he get? 3? 6? An even baker's dozen? And how many miles to Babylon? He stirred restlessly, uneasily. Only Dusander's death would tell the final truth, he supposed. Sometime during the next 5 years, maybe even sooner, 3 to 5. It sounded like a prison sentence. "Todd Bowden, this court hereby sentences you to 3 to 5 for associating with a known war criminal. 3 to 5 at bad dreams and cold sweats." Sooner or later, Dusander would simply drop dead. Then the waiting would begin, the knot in the stomach every time the phone or the doorbell rang. He wasn't sure he could stand that. His fingers itched to hold the gun, and Todd curled them into fists and drove both fists into his crotch. Sick pain swallowed his belly, and he lay for some time afterwards in a writhing ball on the ground, his lips pulled back in a silent shriek. The pain was dreadful, but it blotted out the endless parade of thoughts, at least for a while. 20. For Morris Heisel, that Sunday was a day of miracles. The Atlanta Braves, his favorite baseball team, swept a doubleheader from the high and mighty Cincinnati Reds by scores of 7-1 and 8-0. Lydia, who boasted smugly of always taking care of herself and whose favorite saying was, "An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure," slipped on her friend Janet's wet kitchen floor and sprained her hip. She was at home in bed. It wasn't serious, not at all, and thank God, what God, for that. But it meant she wouldn't be able to visit him for at least 2 days, maybe as long as four. 4 days without Lydia. 4 days that he wouldn't have to hear about how she had warned him that the stepladder was wobbly and how he was up too high on it in the bargain. 4 days when he wouldn't have to listen to her tell him how she'd always said the Rogan's pup was going to cause them grief, always chasing lover boy that way. 4 days without Lydia asking him if he wasn't glad now that she had kept after him about sending in that insurance application, for if she had not, they would surely be on their way to the poorhouse now. 4 days without having Lydia tell him that many people live perfectly normal lives, almost anyway, paralyzed from the waist down. Why, every museum and gallery in the city had wheelchair ramps as well as stairs, and there were even special buses. After the observation, Lydia would smile bravely, and then inevitably burst into tears. Morris drifted off into a contented late afternoon nap. When he woke up, it was 5:30 in the afternoon. His roommate was asleep. He still hadn't placed Denker, but all the same he felt sure that he had known the man at some time or other. He had begun to ask Denker about himself once or twice, but then something kept him from making more than the most banal conversation with the man. The weather, the last earthquake, the next earthquake, and yeah, the guide says Myron Florin is going to come back for a special guest appearance this week on the Welk Show. Morris told himself he was holding back because it gave him a mental game to play, and when you were in a body cast from your shoulders to your hips, mental games can come in handy. If you had a little mental contest going on, you didn't have to spend quite so much time wondering how it was going to be pissing through a catheter for the rest of your life. If he came right out and asked Denker, the mental game would probably come to a swift and unsatisfying conclusion. They would narrow their pasts down to some common experience, a train trip, a boat ride, possibly even the camp. Denker might have been in Patton. There had been plenty of German Jews there. On the other hand, one of the nurses had told him Denker would probably be going home in a week or two. If Morris couldn't figure it out by then, he would mentally declare the game lost and ask the man straight out. Say, I've had the feeling I know you. But there was more to it than just that, he admitted to himself. There was something in his feelings, a nasty sort of undertow, that made him think of that story, The Monkey's Paw, where every wish had been granted as the result of some evil turn of fate. The old couple who came into possession of the paw wished for $100 and received it as a gift of condolence when their only son was killed in a nasty mill accident. Then the mother had wished for the son to return to them. They had heard footsteps dragging up their walk shortly afterward, then pounding on the door. The mother, mad with joy, had gone rushing down the stairs to let in her only child. The father, mad with fear, scrabbled through the darkness for the dried paw, found it at last, and wished his son dead again. The mother threw the door open a moment later and found nothing on the stoop but an eddy of night wind. In some way, Morris felt that perhaps he did know where he and Denker had been acquainted, but that his knowledge was like the son of the old couple in the story, returned from the grave, but not as he was in his mother's memory, returned instead horribly crushed and mangled from his fall into the gnashing, whirling machinery. He felt that his knowledge of Denker might be a subconscious thing, pounding on the door between that area of his mind and that of rational understanding and recognition, demanding admittance, and that another part of him was searching frantically for the monkey's paw, or its psychological equivalent, for the talisman that would wish away the knowledge forever. Now he looked at Denker, frowning. Denker, Denker, where have I known you, Denker? Was it Patton? Is that why I don't want to know? But surely two survivors of a common horror do not have to be afraid of each other. Unless, of course, he frowned. He felt very close to it suddenly, But his feet were tingling, breaking his concentration, annoying him. They were tingling in just the way a limb tingles when you've slept on it and it's returning to normal circulation. If it wasn't for the damn body cast, he could sit up and rub his feet until that tingle went away. He could... Morris's eyes widened. For a long time he lay perfectly still, Lydia forgotten, Denker forgotten, Patton forgotten, everything forgotten, except that tingly feeling in his feet. Yes, both feet, but it was stronger in the right one. When you felt that tingle, you said, "My foot went to sleep." But what you really meant, of course, "My foot is waking up." Morris fumbled for a call button. He pressed it again and again until the nurse came. The nurse tried to dismiss it. She had had hopeful patients before. His doctor wasn't in the building, and the nurse didn't want to call him at home. Dr. Kemmelman had a vast reputation for evil temper, especially when he was called at home. Morris wouldn't let her dismiss it. He was a mild man, but now he was prepared to make more than a fuss. He was prepared to make an uproar, if that's what it took. The Braves had taken two. Lydia had sprained her hip, but good things came in threes. Everyone knew that. At last the nurse came back with an intern, a young man named Dr. Timpnell, whose hair looked as if it had been cut by a lawn boy with very dull blades. Dr. Timpnell pulled a Swiss Army knife from the pocket of his white pants, folded out the Phillips screwdriver attachment, and ran it from the toes of Morris's right foot down to the heel. The foot did not curl, but his toes twitched. It was an obvious twitch, too definite to miss. Morris burst into tears. Timpnell, looking rather dazed, sat beside him on the bed and patted his hand. "This sort of thing happens from time to time," he said, possibly from his wealth of practical experience, which stretched back perhaps as far as 6 months. "No doctor predicts it, but it does happen, and apparently it's happened to you." Morris nodded through his tears. "Obviously you're not totally paralyzed," Timpnell was still patting his hand, "but I wouldn't try to predict if your recovery will be slight, partial, or total. I doubt if Dr. Kemmelman will either. I suspect you'll have to undergo a lot of physical therapy, and not all of it will be pleasant. But it will be more pleasant than, you know." "Yes," Morris said through his tears. "I know. Thank God." He remembered telling Lydia there was no God and felt his face fill up with hot blood. "I'll see that Dr. Kemmelman is informed," Timpnell said, giving Morris's hand a final pat and rising. "Could you call my wife?" Morris asked. Because doom crying and hand-wringing aside, he felt something for her. Maybe it was even love, an emotion which seemed to have little to do with sometimes feeling like you could wring a person's neck. "Yes, I'll see that it's done. Nurse, would you—" "Of course, doctor," the nurse said, and Timpnell could barely stifle his grin. "Thank you," Morris said, wiping his eyes with a Kleenex from the box on the nightstand. "Thank you very much." Timpnell went out. At some point during the discussion, Mr. Denker had awakened. Morris considered apologizing for all the noise, or perhaps for his tears, and then decided no apology was necessary. "You are to be congratulated, I take it," Mr. Denker said. "We'll see," Morris said, but like Timpnell, he was barely able to stifle his grin. "We'll see." "Things have a way of working out," Denker replied vaguely, and then turned on the TV with a remote control device. It was now 5:45, and they watched the last of Hee Haw. It was followed by the evening news. Unemployment was worse. Inflation was not so bad. Billy Carter was thinking about going into the beer business. A new Gallup poll showed that if the election were to be held right then, there were 4 Republican candidates who could beat Billy's brother, Jimmy. And there had been racial incidents following the murder of a black child in Miami. A night of violence, the newscaster called it. Closer to home, an unidentified man had been found in an orchard near Highway 46. Stabbed and bludgeoned. Lydia called just before 6:30. Dr. Kemmelman had called her, and based on the young intern's report, he had been cautiously optimistic. Lydia was cautiously joyous. She vowed to come in the following day, even if it killed her. Morris told her he loved her. Tonight he loved everyone. Lydia, Dr. Timpnell with his lawn boy haircut, Mr. Denker, even the young girl who brought in the supper trays as Morris hung up. Supper was hamburgers, mashed potatoes, a carrots and peas combination, and small dishes of ice cream for dessert. The candy striper who served it was Felice, a shy blonde girl of perhaps 20. She had her own good news. Her boyfriend had landed a job as a computer programmer with IBM and had formally asked her to marry him. Mr. Denker, who exuded a certain courtly charm that all the young ladies responded to, expressed great pleasure. "Really, how wonderful! You must sit down and tell us all about it. Tell us everything. Omit nothing." Felice blushed and smiled and said she couldn't do that. "We've still got the rest of the B-Wing to do, and C-Wing after that. And look, here it is, 6:30. "Then tomorrow night for sure. We insist, don't we, Mr. Heisel?" "Yes, indeed," Morris murmured. But his mind was a million miles away. "You must sit down and tell us all about it." Words spoken in that exact same bantering tone. He had heard them before. Of that there could be no doubt. But had Denker been the one to speak them? Had he? "Tell us everything." The voice of an urbane man, a cultured man. But there was a threat in the voice. A steel hand in a velvet glove, yes. "Where? Tell us everything. Omit nothing." "Patton?" Morris Heisel looked at his supper. Mr. Denker had already fallen to with a will. The encounter with Felice had left him in the best of spirits. The way he had been after the young boy with the blonde hair came to visit him. "A nice girl," Denker said, his words muffled by a mouthful of carrots and peas. "Oh, yes, you must sit down. Felice, you mean, she's..." "And tell us all about it." "Very sweet. Tell us everything. Omit nothing." He looked down at his own supper, suddenly remembering how it got to be in the camps after a while. At first you would have killed for a scrap of meat, no matter how maggoty or green with decay. But after a while that crazy hunger went away and your belly lay inside your middle like a small gray rock. You felt you would never be hungry again, until someone showed you food. "Tell us everything, my friend. Omit nothing. You must sit down and tell us all about it." The main course on Morris's plastic hospital tray was hamburger. Why should it suddenly make him think of lamb? Not mutton, not chops. Mutton was often stringy, chops often tough, and a person whose teeth had rotted out like old stumps would perhaps not be overly tempted by mutton or a chop. No, what he thought of now was a savory lamb stew, gravy-rich and full of vegetables, soft, tasty vegetables. Why think of lamb stew? Why, unless the door banged open? It was Lydia, her face rosy with smiles. An aluminum crutch was propped in her armpit, and she was walking like Marshall Dillon's friend Chester. "Morris!" she trilled. Trailing her and looking just as tremulously happy was Emma Rogan from next door. Mr. Denker, startled, dropped his fork. He cursed softly under his breath and picked it up off the floor with a wince. "It's so wonderful!" Lydia was almost baying with excitement. "I called Emma and asked her if we could come tonight instead of tomorrow. I had the crutch already, and I said, 'Em,' I said, 'if I can't bear this agony for Morris, what kind of wife am I to him?' Those were my very words, weren't they, Emma?" Emma Rogan, perhaps remembering that her collie pup had caused at least some of the problem, nodded eagerly. "So I called the hospital," Lydia said, shrugging her coat off and settling in for a good long visit. "And they said it was past visiting hours, but in my case they would make an exception. Except we couldn't stay too long because we might bother Mr. Denker. We aren't bothering you, are we, Mr. Denker?"
"No, dear lady," Mr. Denker said resignedly.
"Sit down, Emma. Take Mr. Denker's chair. He's not using it. Here, Morris, stop with the ice cream. You're slobbering it all over yourself just like a baby. And never mind, we'll have you up and around in no time. I'll feed it to you. Goo, goo, ga, ga, open wide. Over the teeth, over the gums. Look out, stomach, here it comes. Now, don't say a word. Mommy knows best. Would you look at him, Emma? He has hardly any hair left, and I don't wonder, thinking he might never walk again. It's God's mercy. I told him that stepladder was wobbly. I said, 'Morris,' I said, 'come down off there before—'
She fed him ice cream and chattered for the next hour, and by the time she left, hobbling ostentatiously on the crutch while Emma held her other arm, thoughts of lamb stew and voices echoing up through the years were the last things in Morris Heisel's mind. He was exhausted,
To say it had been a busy day was putting it mildly. Morris fell deeply asleep. He awoke some time between 3 and 4 a.m., with a scream locked behind his lips. Now he knew. He knew exactly where and exactly when he had been acquainted with the man in the other bed. Except his name had not been Denker then. Oh, no, not at all. He had awakened from the most terrible nightmare of his whole life. Someone had given him and Lydia a monkey's paw, and they had wished for money. Then somehow a Western Union boy in a Hitler Youth uniform had been in the room with them. He handed Morris a telegram which read, "Regret to inform you, both daughters dead, stop, Patton concentration camp, stop, greatest regrets at this final solution, stop, commandant's letter follows, stop, will you tell everything and omit nothing, stop, please accept our check for 100 Reichmarks on deposit your bank tomorrow, stop, signed Adolf Hitler, Chancellor." A great wail from Lydia. And although she had never even seen Morris's daughter, she held the monkey's paw high and wished for them to be returned to life. The room went dark, and suddenly from outside came the sound of dragging, lurching footfalls. Morris was down on his hands and knees in a darkness that suddenly stank of smoke and gas and death. He was searching for the paw. One wish left. If he could find the paw, he could wish this dreadful dream away. He would spare himself the sight of his daughters, thin as scarecrows, their eyes deep wounded holes, their numbers burning on the scant flesh of their arms. Hammering on the door. In the nightmare, his search for the paw became ever more frenzied, but it bore no fruit. It seemed to go on for years, and then, behind him, the door crashed open. No, he thought, I won't look. I'll close my eyes, rip them from my head if I have to, but I won't look. But he did look. He had to look. In the dream, it was as if huge hands had grasped his head and wrenched it around. It was not his daughter standing in the doorway. It was Denker, a much younger Denker, a Denker who wore a Nazi SS uniform, the cap with its death's head insignia cocked rakishly to one side. His buttons gleamed heartlessly. His boots were polished to a killing gloss. Clasped in his arms was a huge and slowly bubbling pot of lamb stew. And the dream Denker, smiling his dark, suave smile, said, "You must sit down and tell us all about it, as one friend to another, eh? We have heard that gold has been hidden, that tobacco has been hoarded, that it was not food poisoning with Schneibel at all, but powdered glass in his supper 2 nights ago. You must not insult our intelligence by pretending you know nothing. You knew everything, so tell it all. Omit nothing."